dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. When a nation is invaded by another, little urging by the state is needed to call its people to arms as they are fighting for their homes and lives. But what motivates the general populace in the aggressor nation? The one who mounts the attack. The following historical anecdote is enlightening. On April 18, 1946, an Allied intelligence officer, Gustav Gilbert, interviewed Nazi Reichsmarshal and convicted war criminal Hermann Göring, who was awaiting execution following the Nuremberg war crimes trials. In the notes of the interview, Gilbert wrote that he brought up the subject of war to Göring, and commented that he did not think the common people are very thankful to leaders who bring them war and destruction. "Why, of course the people don't want war," Göring shrugged. "Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor, for that matter, in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy, or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, or a communist dictatorship." "There is one difference," Gilbert replied. "In a democracy, the people have some say in the matter through their elected representatives, and in the United States, only Congress can declare wars." Göring replied, "Oh, that is all well and good, but, voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked, and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. If the common people do not gain from war, who does? Tonight, we look at the hidden motivation and public justifications behind the Bush administration's war in Iraq. Our program this week features a lecture and discussion with Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine Corps major who served for 12 years as an intelligence officer and ballistic missile expert. In 1991, he joined the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team, UNSCOM, in Iraq, where he took part in more than 50 inspection missions, 14 of them as chief inspector. He resigned his position in 1998 when the UN Security Council refused to confront the Iraqi government over its refusal to allow inspections at certain sites, and Ritter concluded that there was more interest in the appearance of arms control than in the actuality. Ritter, who describes himself as a conservative Republican and a patriot, has surprised many by becoming an outspoken opponent of the Bush administration's attack on Iraq. He spoke to a packed house on March 27th at Cornell University in Ithaca. A lengthy question period followed Ritter's presentation. "We were denied permission to make our own recording, and as a result, we've had to rely on piecing together that talk from other audio sources. For this reason, the audio quality on the first 12 minutes of the talk is poor. We apologize, but believe you'll find the content worth the effort. As a result of the same situation regarding the taping, only the first 90 minutes of the presentation was available. This includes the entirety of Ritter's prepared remarks and a portion of the question period."
You know, this is a tough time for us all, I think. A nation at war is something that should never be taken lightly, regardless of the justification of the war or lack thereof. I think we need to be sober in the recognition that 250,000 of our fellow citizens are, as we speak, in harm's way. And some of those alive. Some of those aren't going to come home in one piece, and many of them are going to come home with emotional scars. That's the reality of war. Again, whether or not you agree with this war or disagree with this war, we should never forget that those are our fellow citizens over there. And that, to me, should be the focus of our attention, and that indeed is what I'm going to focus on tonight, is to talk about this war with Iraq and how we as a people may want to view our actions in response to this war. This is a tough one for me because I think people here will recognize that I have been a very vocal critic of the Bush administration's policies in regards to Iraq. And I have taken on a persona of anti-war activist, which is, of course, wrong, because I'm not anti-war. Being a former Marine, serving for 12 years and having fought in the war, I'm someone who recognizes, at least from my own personal opinion, that war sometimes is required if that which you believe in is threatened. I'm also someone who respects the pledge that I took and every one of those service members took when they joined the military, the oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I am a firm believer that if the nation, which is defined by that Constitution, comes under threat of attack, comes under threat which puts at risk its very existence, then that is something worth fighting for, and indeed something worth dying for. And we have an obligation never to forget that those men and women who serve our country so proudly today are willing to give their lives for us. And we need to ask ourselves, therefore, what are we willing to do for them? So here we are, a nation at war. How do we judge this? Where do we go forward in terms of evaluating not only how we got here, but why we're here and where we're going?
I think the starting point is to begin by assessing what it is we're trying to accomplish. And I'll just give you an analogy that is relevant, at least to me. It may not be relevant to you, but it's that from the perspective of a firefighter. I think we can all identify with firefighters. They serve our communities. Firefighters are professionals. They're people who are courageous. They will put their lives on the line to rescue us, to protect us. So if we have a building on fire, a wooden structure, flames coming out the roof, and the fire chief shows up, and he's evaluating the structure, because the first thing the firefighter is going to do is evaluate the situation. And they look at things differently. Non-professionals will look and say, my God, a house on fire. We need to do something. The firefighter is going to look at it and say, there's a house, and he's going to view the house as potential fuel. And he's going to take a look at the size of the flames and say, those flames are generating so many BTUs, there's enough fuel here to feed that fire in the following fashion. And then the fire truck shows up. And two firefighters, very brave, grab a hose and run into the building. And that fire chief's going to look there, and if he's smart, he'll say, stop. Because his professional evaluation will be that no matter how brave those firefighters are, no matter how courageous they are, no matter how good their tactics are once they get into the building to start attacking the fire, they don't have enough water to put out that fire. And the professional firefighter is going to say, in 30 minutes, no matter what they do, this house is going down. Now, what happens if that fire chief allows those firefighters to go in, fight the fire, and the building collapses? It is called dereliction of duty. The fire chief has failed. The fire chief's responsibility at that point in time is to stop the firefighters from entering the building and contain the damage done. To do anything other than that is a dereliction of duty. Now, I'm going to put this in perspective, because lately I have come under a lot of criticism for some comments I've made. I had the audacity to tell someone in the media that we lost this war, that we cannot win this war, that no matter what transpires, the United States military will come home from Iraq with its tail between its legs in defeat. And people said, how dare you say that? How dare you disgrace the honorable service being given to us right now by the men and women in uniform? But I just ask you to reflect on this for a second. respect the fact that I'm somebody who has served in the military, who has served as a plaintiff in war, who has engaged in combat, and furthermore, somebody who has served in Iraq.
And intimately knows the terrain of Iraq, intimately knows the military of Iraq, the government of Iraq, the nature of Iraq. So I evaluate, I size up the situation from the standpoint of a fire chief looking at a fire scene. And what I see is this: a stated policy as put forward by the Bush administration that defines victory as the liberation of Iraq, defines victory in terms of putting in place a democratic government in Iraq, defines victory as building upon this new Iraqi democracy to transform the Middle East into a model of Western-style liberal democracy. That is victory. That is the golden objective. The same way as a firefighter looks at a burning building and says, victory is putting out the fire. So now that we've examined that, let's take a look at the tools that we have brought to bear. A military campaign. A military campaign which is designed to achieve this objective. Now those who planned this military campaign came up with a radical new way of waging war called effects-based warfare. They threw away age-old concepts of military doctrine that speak of overwhelming power. And let's be frank about what war is, okay? I don't want to fool anybody here. In the Marine Corps, they always cut it down to the chase. What was our goal and objective? What was our mission statement as Marines? To close with and destroy the enemy through firepower and maneuver. Basically, to get close enough to put a bullet into the chest of somebody, to terminate their life, to bring artillery down and rip their body apart, to put a main tank round through another tank, incinerating those inside. You close with and destroy the enemy through firepower and maneuver. That is warfare. There is no other way to talk about it. It's about death and destruction. It's about putting more bodies on the ground than the enemy has. It's about bringing more firepower to bear than the enemy has. It's about dominating the enemy, but not in a wrestling match term. Dominating through death. To kill more of them than they kill of you. That is war, and yet we have had people who have decided to change the nature of warfare when we speak of Iraq. You see, we are not going to hit them with overwhelming military force. It will be effects-based strategy. Why? Because we don't want to destroy Iraq. We want to liberate Iraq. And to liberate Iraq, we
must have the support of the Iraqi people. So the first thing is, we convince the Iraqi people that they want to be liberated, or we fool ourselves into believing they want to be liberated. But either way, we set forward as a precondition for victory the fact that the Iraqi people desire liberation and therefore will be supportive of our efforts, that we will not receive resistance from the Iraqi people. Precondition for victory number one. The second precondition is that the Iraqi military will not defend the regime. The Iraqi military will fold up their cards and walk away from the game, surrender, or turn on Saddam Hussein's regime and facilitate his elimination. Precondition number two. Precondition number three, that the Iraqi regime itself is very fragile, that it can't sustain resistance to an effort designed to eliminate it, that Saddam Hussein will be toppled by those in the regime who seek self-preservation, that there is no mandate for Saddam Hussein to exist as the ruler of Iraq. Precondition number four, that the international community will rally behind us, legitimizing our actions regardless of how we initiated this conflict. It doesn't matter that we walked away from the United Nations. Our cause is so just, and our victory is so predetermined, the demise of Saddam Hussein is so inevitable, that the world, once they are convinced that America will follow through, will line up behind us. For this reason, we don't bring to bear overwhelming military force. We bring to bear enough military force to achieve the perception of military power, not the reality of military power. We design an air campaign which is built around the concepts of shock and awe, not the concepts of destruction, but shock and awe. And we incorporate a psychological operation, information warfare, that permeates the airwaves with the inevitability of Saddam's defeat, the inevitability of our victory. We repeat the following mantra: the people of Iraq want to be liberated. The Iraqi army will not resist. You will lose. Do not fight us, because if to fight us, you will die. You have no chance of victory. And we say it over and over and over again. Effects-based strategy, transformational warfare, whatever you want to call it. That's the new way of fighting, according to Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And that is what we are waging today. So we initiate action. We start off with a decapitation attack against Saddam Hussein. Or was it? We throw bombs in there and we say, Saddam's dead. We announce it. We killed Saddam. And then we flood Iraq with emails and cell phone calls to the various generals and leadership saying, Saddam is dead. Rise up. Eliminate the war. Quit. Surrender. And when they don't surrender, we hit them with shock and awe. Boom, boom, boom. The most fantastic display of pyrotechnics the world has ever seen. Put out live on TV for the whole world to see. The inevitability of victory. The inevitability of Iraqi defeat. And then we come in with our military and we do amazing things. We take the 3rd Armored Division and we throw it 200 plus miles up the western flank of the Euphrates and park it 50 miles outside of Baghdad. The inevitability of defeat. No military in the world has moved this fast. And we convince the Iraqis that they can't resist. They must surrender. And what happened? None of it worked. You see, the scam we tried to pull on night one, Saddam is dead, was actually a scam in reverse on us. The CIA thought they had hot information, but the CIA has been suckered for a long time by the Iraqis. In 1996, the Iraqis had convinced the CIA that there was a group ready to launch a coup against Saddam Hussein. So 2 days before the coup was supposed to launch, the phone rings of the CIA station chief in Amman, Jordan. And it's the head of the Iraqi intelligence service saying, "We got you." They rolled them all up. They killed them. The CIA didn't have a chance. Well, they got us again, you see. The CIA was suckered. The CIA was suckered into launching a decapitation attack against a target in southern Baghdad. And then the CIA was led to believe that Saddam is dead. So the CIA floods Iraq with emails and cell phone calls saying Saddam is dead. And the people they flooded to are the people they think are going to come over. And what happened? Many of those people who they were in contact with were also being controlled by the Iraqi government. And the ones that weren't being controlled are no longer alive because the CIA identified them. And the Iraqi government has said, gotcha. So now we move in with our military. We launch this great attack. But the problem is the Iraqi people didn't want to be liberated. You see, we went 200 miles into Baghdad, but we left our supply lines unprotected under the assumption that the Shia population of southern Iraq would rise up and say, welcome, liberators. Instead, they said, ooh, a nice juicy supply line for us to chew on for a little while. And that's what they've done. And if you know anything about modern warfare, we consume an awful lot of gas. We consume an awful lot of ammunition. Our tanks and fighting vehicles require a hell of a lot of maintenance, which means we need a lot of spare parts. And they're moving 200 miles up an exposed line of communication. Yesterday, no supply trucks made it to the 3rd Armored Division. The entire supply line is stopped because the Iraqis are blowing up our trucks, are interdicting our forces, and we have to bleed our combat strength away to come down and secure the supply line. Suddenly, we aren't looking so invincible anymore to the Iraqi army, which, by the way, decided to fight. They didn't surrender. And remember, we had the inevitability of surrender. We announced the surrender of the division commander of the 51st Division. Hell, we announced the whole 51st Division surrendered, as if by saying it, it made it so. You see, we actually believed if we announced the surrender of the 51st Division, they would surrender. They're in Basra right now, dug in, fighting. They're not surrendering. So we shock and awe them. We pounded Baghdad with a pyrotechnics display. But I've always said, what happens at the end of shock and awe when the Iraqis wake up, dust themselves off, and say, come and get us? Shock and awe no longer works. Effects-based strategy no longer works. So we are not going to have the quick victory that was promised to the president when he agreed to this campaign. Instead, we're going to have to fight a drawn-out, bloody battle for Iraq. And it will be drawn out, and it will be bloody, and it will be awful. We have lost this war before it began,
because by fighting a long, drawn-out, bloody battle, a couple things are occurring here. A, no way in God's name are the Iraqi people ever going to rally behind the cause of the American occupation. We are the enemy. We are the invader. Last week, there was an important event on the calendar that maybe a lot of people in this room aren't aware of. An important day if you're a Shia Muslim. It's a day in which you celebrate the Battle of Karbala, the day in which you celebrate the resistance of Hussein against the evil Yazid. I used to say Yazid, but a Cornell professor corrected me. It's Yazid. Don't trust a former Marine. We are very simple people. Yazid. And the way it goes in the 8th century, Hussein was a proponent of the poor. Yazid was a proponent of the rich powers. And Yazid surrounded Hussein and his followers and said, "We will starve you out unless you bend to our will and succumb to us." And Hussein, rather than bending to his will, led his followers out in a decisive battle in which he was martyred. They were defeated. And today, instead of having the Shia population rising up in support of the American military invasion of Iraq, the clerics in southern Iraq are issuing sermons that go along this line. There is a modern-day Yazid, and his name is Bush. And there is a modern-day Hussein, and his name is Saddam. And it is time for the Shia to rally around Hussein and confront Yazid. No, the Shia aren't on our side. They are our enemy. And to punctuate this, reflect on the fact that there is a group in Iraq called the Dawah, which is a hardcore group of Shia fundamentalists who are very much opposed to Saddam Hussein and his regime. In fact, they are the most feared element of the resistance in regards to Saddam Hussein and his inner circle, because they have come closer than anybody to killing Saddam Hussein and his inner circle. Dawah, this week, has come forward and instructed its fighters, 8 to 10,000 embedded inside Iraq, to fight against the American invader on the side of Saddam Hussein. We have failed when we have Dawah joining with Saddam to oppose the United States. No, we're not going to win this war. We may win the tactical engagements. We have the finest military in the world. We know how to fight. That's why we're slaughtering the Iraqis as we speak. When they want to sit down and fight, we win. But we're going to die a death of 1,000 cuts. A tank here, a tank there, a soldier here, a Marine there. We'll kill 100 here, 200 there. You know, don't look at body counts. That was a mistake we made in Vietnam. How else can we explain killing over 2 million Vietnamese, losing 58,000 Americans, and still losing the war? A people that do not want to be defeated don't look at body counts. They will continue to die resisting the invader. The Iraqis today view us as the invader, and they will die resisting us. We cannot win this war militarily. We can't win this war diplomatically. We've already blown it with the United Nations. The Security Council did not give us authority. So understand this. Under international law, we are violators. We are waging a war of aggression that lacks a mandate from the Security Council. Now, that's an important term, war of aggression. I would ask you to go back and review the words of Justice Jackson on the Nuremberg trial in 1946, when he condemned German generals and politicians to death for the crime of waging war of aggression. Justice Jackson said that a war of aggression is the worst of war crimes, because within a war of aggression, all other war crimes exist. The United States is waging a war of aggression today. I don't care how you parse it, we lack legitimacy in the eyes of international law. We do not have the authority of the Security Council of the United Nations. This war of aggression has divorced us from the concepts, the frameworks of international law as set forth in the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Charter was put out there at the end of World War II so there would be no more war of aggression. The United Nations Charter forswears war as a means of resolving disputes between nations. Now, some people will say, well, we're Americans. We don't have to pay attention to that United Nations Charter thing. If you're Americans, that means that you believe in the Constitution of the United States. I would hope that would be the case. Constitution of the United States is an important document, and I encourage everybody in this room to read it and become familiar with it, because it defines who we are as a people. It's why those service members are dying right now, dying to defend the Constitution. So the question is, are they really defending the Constitution? The Constitution, Article 6, says that when we enter into an international agreement or treaty that has been ratified by 2/3 United States Senate, that is the law of the land here in America. We are signatories to the United Nations Charter, and the Charter has been ratified. It is the law. So for us to wage a war against Iraq void of legitimacy from the United Nations means we are violating not only international law, but the Constitution of the United States of America. We are asking people who are sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution to give their lives in a cause which is not worthy of the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't sustain this conflict. We are waging an illegal war of aggression. We are waging a war that has been justified by the President of the United States as regime removal. And let me tell you something right now. I am not up here to speak on behalf of Saddam Hussein or his regime. There's not too many Americans who know more than I do about the true nature of this regime, how truly horrible this man is, how tyrannical he is, the crimes he has committed. No, I'm not here to defend Saddam Hussein. I'm here to defend the Constitution of the United States of America. See, the Constitution, again, embraces the United Nations Charter because we are signatories. It has been ratified. And the Charter prohibits regime removal. No nation or group of nations has the right to select the leadership of a sovereign state. That is the sole prerogative of the people of that country. So when the President of the United States says that his policy in regards to Iraq is regime removal, what he's really saying is, I don't give a damn about the Constitution. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen, when we reflect on this war that's being waged right now. Is this a war worthy of the sacrifice we're asking these heroes of America, our national treasure, the men and women who wear our uniform? And it is our uniform. Read the Constitution. We, the people of the United States of America. We live in a nation that is a democratic republic, a government of the people, by the people, for the people. If we want to truly call ourselves democratic in nature, then we have to understand that the government works for us. There must be a system of accountability. We have to hold into account those whom we elect to higher office for what they do in our name. The men and women who put on the uniform and service so proudly in Iraq took an oath to the Constitution. They didn't take an oath to the President. They didn't take an oath to Congress. They didn't take an oath to the White House or to any individual or institution. They took an oath to a piece of paper that defines who we are as a nation. Therefore, we have a responsibility as a people to ensure that those who are directing the military to do things are doing so in a manner which reflects not only the spirit of the Constitution, but the letter of the Constitution, that reflects the values and ideals that we aspire to as a people. And I dare say that we have not achieved this when it comes to Iraq. We have lost diplomatically. We have lost the war diplomatically because the world will not support us. President Bush speaks of a coalition of the willing. Perhaps a better term is a coalition of the billing. The people that we have bribed, the people that we have intimidated. Even Great Britain, the staunchest of our allies, who has committed up to 40,000 troops in support of this battle. Great Britain is waging this war not out of any sense of support for the American position per se, but rather out of a sense of necessity that comes from the realization that Great Britain today is a very minor state with a faltering economy, that if it seeks to be a member of the European Union on a equal basis with the rest of Europe, will forever consign itself to middle nation status. The only thing that gives Great Britain the ability to stand apart from Europe is a special relationship with the United States that has existed since World War II. That is why Tony Blair, when speaking about his defense of President Bush's policy in Iraq before the Parliament, said, I am willing to pay a blood price to maintain this special relationship. So that's why Great Britain's in this coalition, to maintain a special relationship, and they are paying a blood price. Spain, you remember those three great leaders that stood in the Azores to announce the war with Iraq? Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, no, I'm sorry, Bush, Blair, Aznar. Spain is the other big member of this coalition. And what brings Spain on board? They've committed how many ground troops into combat? Why does Spain want to join? Because Spain has taken a look at its situation vis-a-vis the European Union and understands that it needs an edge to separate itself from the Franco-German axis. That if Spain seeks to just be a normal European nation, it is forever consigning itself to middle nation status. Spain wants a special relationship with the United States so that it stands apart like Great Britain. And see, this is in the interest of the United States of America, especially the Bush administration, because by fracturing Europe, you prevent Europe from uniting. You deny Europe the ability to form a political, economic federation that can challenge the United States. No, we have a policy, you see, under the Bush administration of preventing just that kind of thing from happening. It's promulgated in a national security strategy that was published last September, the strategy of unilateralism, the strategy of preemptive strike, the strategy that says that America is the sole remaining superpower, that there is no competition right now, and we need to sustain this situation by exploiting our overwhelming strength economically and militarily to ensure that we never again have equals. So a threat to our national security is now defined as a nation or group of nations that seek to be our equal, not superior, but equal militarily or economically. We alone have the ability to define this. We don't speak of multilateralism. We don't speak of international law. We speak of American national security interests as defined by the United States and as solved by the United States. We define the problem. We define the solution. And if that solution is of a certain nature, then we can preemptively strike. That's the Bush policy. So we want Spain to break away from the European Union because we feel threatened by a unified European Union. So we have the brave Aznar in the Azores supporting this coalition of the willing. It's growing too, 47 now. Let's take a look at who are in those 47. Former Eastern European countries dominate. Countries that the United States has bribed, threatened, cajoled. It's telling that in the spring of 2002, Lord Robertson, the Secretary General of NATO, came to the United States and met with President Bush to discuss war on Iraq. Don't let anybody tell you that the president went into this war unwillingly. It's been his design from day one to eliminate Saddam Hussein through military power. Robertson met with President Bush and then went back to NATO. Instead of going to the NATO General Assembly and speaking to the NATO membership, he went directly to those nations that were preparing to join NATO, and he gave them all a message. America will veto your application if you do not support the war with Iraq. That's how we got a coalition of the willing. This isn't a true coalition. We lack international support, and everything we are doing in Iraq as we speak is further fracturing international opinion in regards to the United States. I grew up in Europe as a child, and you know, we've always been a little bit unpopular because we have so much power and so much strength. But people always looked to the United States, wherever you went. They looked up to us because we stood for something good. We weren't perfect. I mean, even during the Vietnam War, though, when the world despised what we were doing in Vietnam, they looked to us as a symbol of liberty, democracy, and freedom. We aren't viewed that way anymore. Sad to say, I've spent the last couple months traveling around the world, from France, those cheese-eating surrender monkeys, you can never trust them. They don't like us, but we expected that from the French. The Germans, they don't have any spine anymore. What happened to the good Prussians? No, we got these weak Germans. The Italians, Berlusconi is on our side, but I have to tell you, Italy put 2 million people in the streets of Rome against this war. The Italians don't support us. Spain, Aznar, put 1 million people in the streets of Madrid. They don't support us. Japan, they don't like us. United Arab Emirates, they don't like us. And you know you've screwed up when the Canadians no longer like us. So we have failed diplomatically. We will not win this war on the diplomatic front because the world will never rally behind the cause of the United States. We have failed economically. This war is a disaster for the economy of the United States of America. This war is a disaster for the economy of the world. We already have a faltering economy, one that's staggered under tax cuts that seem to make no sense, and yet every time there appears to be an economic problem, we seek more tax cuts as a solution. We're going to war with Iraq, and the president still wants tax cuts, although he needs $75 billion to pay for this war. But ladies and gentlemen, this war is going to cost more than $75 billion. This war has the potential of costing $200 billion, maybe $500 billion. Some people have even put out there, if this war doesn't end by the end of summer, $1 trillion price tag. $1 trillion. One of the first victims of this war economically would be the American airline industry. There's a potential of 99,000 jobs being terminated within a month and a half if this war doesn't end. And I know one thing about the American people. They vote their pocketbooks. And if the economy falters, Bush is dead politically. So Bush has lost this war politically as well. So you may say that's a good thing. But the problem is, this is not the manner in which to achieve the political demise of George W. Bush, because it's being achieved with the blood of American service members. It's being achieved with the blood of innocent Iraqis. It's being achieved with a moral stain on America that will follow us for generations. My children will not be welcomed in the world in the same manner I was welcomed in the world, and this is a very bad thing. And what I've just put forward isn't any stunning revelation. Your basic freshman in international government or international policies 101 could have written this same paper, and they'll be right. It's not a difficult thing to surmise. It's like a firefighter showing up at a burning building and figuring out that that hose ain't going to put out that fire. And yet we've gone forward anyways. And so let me ask you, is it unpatriotic of me to say we're going to lose this war? Or is it the proper thing to identify up front so that we don't compound the error? Is it cowardly for the fire chief to pull the firefighters back from the building? Those firefighters think they can take on that fire. They are courageous. They have the tactics. They have a hose. They have water. They have air tanks. They can do it all. But the fire chief knows that building's going down no matter what they do. And I'm telling you right now, anybody who takes a look at the situation in Iraq understands that we're coming out of this on the short end of the stick. So at what point in time do we stand up and say no more? When did it become politically correct during Vietnam to say enough is enough? On retrospect, should we have stood up as a people and opposed this effort in Vietnam in 1960, in 1962, in 1964, in 1965, 66? Tell me when to stop, ladies and gentlemen, because every time I stop before the ultimate date, thousands of American lives are saved. Billions of dollars of national treasure aren't being squandered. Our national reputation isn't being trashed. The lives of innocent Vietnamese aren't being lost. So how far do we back it down now? When does it become acceptable to say no to a war that is not justified? At what point? It's a dereliction of duty for us as American citizens not to oppose a war with all our strength if we believe this war is not justified. Now, there will be those who say, fair enough, Mr. Ritter, we buy into that, but we think this war is justified. After all, isn't Saddam Hussein in violation of Security Council resolutions calling for his disarmament? And the answer is technically yes. I'll be the first to admit that Saddam Hussein has not fully cooperated with the United Nations in regards to their obligation to disarm. But is that a just cause to go to war? Shouldn't we go to war if Iraq constitutes a threat to the security of the United States or the international community of which we're a part of? I believe we should. So the question is Iraq a threat? Can you translate a failure to fully comply with an obligation to disarm into possession of weapons of mass destruction that pose a threat to our national security? The President of the United States believes so. The President of the United States has said, we are going to war because Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. It's a statement of fact from the President. Iraq has chemical weapons. Iraq has biological weapons. Iraq is moving towards a nuclear weapons program that can reach viability within a period of months. And worse, Iraq has links to international terror. Those who perpetrated the horrific events of September 11, 2001. And that these links are magnified and become a huge threat when we consider that Iraq can transfer their weapons of mass destruction capability to these terrorists who can launch an attack against the United States in proxy fashion, making the events of September 11th pale in comparison. And I have to tell you, when you hear this, it makes you say this war is justified, because if going to war with Iraq and terminating the leadership of Saddam Hussein prevents Iraq from providing the terrorists with weapons of mass destruction that they can use to attack the United States, I say so be it, Mr. President. Where do I sign? How do I join this fight? But I have a couple questions first, Mr. President. You see, because this is a democracy. You work for me. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions. Mr. President, you say Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. You say it with certainty. Iraq has chemical weapons. Well, that implies certainty of knowledge, which means you must be in possession of some facts. So I'd like you to share the facts with me, Mr. President. How do you know this? You say they have them. Prove it. Show it to me. Should be an easy thing to do if you're saying it with such certainty. And this is a question I'm really going to ask with my 7 years' experience in Iraq as a weapons inspector. Because, Mr. President, I got a problem here, you see. I've been all over Iraq. I've investigated this problem. And while I can't account for everything, I can account for 90 to 95% of what Iraq produced. I can account for 100% of the factories that Iraq used to produce it, together with their associated production equipment. And then I can mitigate against this unknown final disposition of 5 to 10% by noting that from 1994 to 1998, I put in place the most intrusive arms control regime in the history of arms control. No notice inspections, cameras, sniffers, you name it, we did it. And we never found any evidence of retained prohibited capability or efforts by Iraq to reconstitute a manufacturing base. So, Mr. President, if Iraq is to have chemical weapons today, they would have had to rebuild a manufacturing base since 1998. So, Mr. President, please demonstrate to me where this is and what it is. But no, that's not, we don't get an argument that says the Iraqis have factories today. They tried that before the inspectors went back in on this round. You remember in the fall of 2002, the various Defense Department briefings where they put photographs of factories up on the wall and said, these factories are being rebuilt by the Iraqis and they're being used to produce weapons of mass destruction. And yet, the United Nations weapons inspectors went to every single one of those sites and more provided by the CIA and found nothing. No evidence of ongoing activity or evidence that Iraq has done anything of an illegal nature in the last 4 years in those factories. No, Mr. President, that argument doesn't fly. So what do you do, Mr. President, to back up your assertions? Go to Colin Powell. Remember the President in the State of Union address said, I'm sending Colin Powell to the United Nations and he's going to make the case. And Colin Powell made the case, all right. He said Iraq has 1,000 tons of chemical agent that's unaccounted for and we need to be afraid of, very afraid. And he backed up this assertion by saying, there's a document, an Air Force document found by weapons inspectors in the summer of 1998 that shows a discrepancy of 6,500 munitions. And if you take the agent that could be possessed by these or contained in these, that's 1,000 tons. And we can't account for it, so it exists and it's ready to be used. But tell the rest of the story. I mean, Paul Harvey, you know, now we want to know the rest of the story. Well, the rest of the story is actually pretty easy, you see. Those weapons, that Air Force document speaks of chemical weapons that Iraq had between 1983 and 1988. Weapons that were employed during the Iran-Iraq War. Yeah, we have an accounting problem. We have a shortfall. But you know, it doesn't matter. Because we have a finding from the world's best chemical warfare specialists who said any Iraqi weapon produced between 1983 and 1988, the period in time in question, given the poor quality control of the Iraqi manufacture process and the poor quality of the weapon can no longer be viable. In fact, the best weapon produced during that period of time had a lifespan of 5 years. So if you're speaking of 1,000 tons of chemical agent that existed between the period of 1983 and 1988, notice that even if it was all produced in 1988, it would have lost viability in 1993. So, Mr. President, don't tell me we're going to war because Iraq has chemical agent that is derived from that calculation, because that chemical agent, through the laws of science, can't exist unless you're going to tell me that Saddam Hussein, because he is such an all-powerful dictator, can reverse the laws of scientists. Can Saddam Hussein make an apple go up? If you show me he can do that, I'll believe there's 1,000 tons of chemical agent. But until you do that, don't tell me that that is a threat. But now we're told, you see, that we couldn't prove that they have chemical weapons, but now we got chemical suits in Iraq. And that is a smoking gun, you see. The American troops have found a hospital full of thousands of chemical suits, neatly folded up, by the way. I always thought if you're going to use chemical weapons, you want to be wearing the suit, not having it folded up in a hospital. Why would Iraq have chemical suits? There's a whole range of options. One, they've got chemical weapons and they're going to use them against us. We have to consider that. No responsible military commander would go to war against Iraq and not be prepared for Iraq's use of chemical weapons. Two, the Iraqis, knowing that we suspect they have chemical weapons and knowing that we're going to go to war prepared for that, knowing that we're going to wear chemical biological uniforms. Have you ever worn these things? These charcoal impregnated pieces of cloth? It's like wearing multiple layers of canvas. It's hot, it's uncomfortable. Plus you're wearing combat equipment. You know what happens to your combat efficiency, to your fatigue factors when you're wearing these uniforms? They drop considerably. So if I'm an Iraqi saying, my strength is being light and mobile, and I want to slow these Americans down a little bit, keep them in their chemical equipment. Create the perception. That's one thing that could be going on. Two, it could just be doctrine. Or three, I guess I'm in third. See, Marines, we don't do math very well either. Three, doctrine. World War II, the Americans went into battle wearing gas masks. The Germans went into battle carrying gas masks. Did the Germans or the Americans use chemical warfare in World War II? No. But it was doctrine. Doctrine that evolved from the First World War, where both sides used it. Iraq is a nation that has a military doctrine that incorporates chemical defense. You see, Iraq fought an 8-year war with Iran. Both sides use chemical weapons. Only one side has been disarmed. Iran still has chemical weapons. Iraq is a nation that still has the potential of military confrontation with Iran. Wouldn't it therefore be responsible for Iraq to preposition considerable stocks of chemical protective suits? So what's going through the mind of the Iraqis? I don't know. What I'm trying to tell you is that these chemical suits are not a smoking gun. They aren't representative of anything. But beware of the shrill nature of this cry to convict Iraq of this crime. Recall Najaf. We all heard the Fox News report, or at least the way the media reported the Fox News report, about the Najaf chemical weapons factory. You know, the one the 3rd Infantry Division went up and found it, and suddenly it's flashed around. We have proven that Iraq has chemical weapons because American soldiers have found a chemical weapons factory. And everybody bought into it. What I'm going to ask everybody to do from now on in this war is to take a deep breath when they hear a report like this and step back, pull out your thinking cap and put it on. Because suddenly things take a different perspective here. Najaf. What is Najaf? It's a Shia city. It's the shrine of Ali, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Shia want to be buried here, so it's full of Shia graves. It's a holy site, a holy city. It's a city that revolted against Saddam in 1991. And that revolt was put down brutally by Saddam Hussein's military. It's a city that is not necessarily the most loyal of locations to the regime. Iraq says it doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. They want to hide, if they have it, they want to hide this fact from the world. So why in God's name would you put a chemical weapons factory in Najaf, in a population base that doesn't like you? Doesn't make any sense. But let's just assume they did it. The Iraqis were going to fool everybody and put it in a place they never thought we'd look, although I spent a lot of time in Najaf looking over the place and never found the chemical weapons factory. I was confused as hell when someone said one exists. I said, how can it exist? I've been everywhere. Apparently not there. No. Najaf, the chemical weapons factory, strategic asset. If there is a chemical factory in Najaf and it was found by the American troops, it would, in one fell swoop, bring the whole world on our side. You see, if Iraq is found to have chemical weapons, then the world will say the Americans are justified in waging this war. So Iraq will want to defend this, to hide this. You'd expect a Republican Guard division to be parked on this factory, fighting tooth and nail to defend this factory against discovery. But what did the report say? 30 troops who surrendered without a fight. Is that how you defend a chemical weapons plant? I don't know. But let's take a look at the report. Where'd it come from? What was the original source? A Jerusalem Post reporter embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division. Now, the Jerusalem Post has a record of being objective and balanced when it comes to issues pertaining to Iraq. This Jerusalem Post reporter immediately contacted Fox News, another fair and balanced source of news. Fox News put this information out there. Suddenly it was all over Fox News. Reuters, not to be outdone, wrote a big wire story on it, quoting Fox News as the source. And everybody picked it up. And suddenly the whole world's talking about the chemical weapons factory in Najaf. When you turned on Fox News, you had some neat things happening. All these talking heads coming up and talking about this chemical weapons factory as if it existed and speculating about what it could be. So let's speculate for a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I want to put your minds at rest about the Iraqi chemical weapons threat. Chemical weapons to be militarily viable. Anybody got an idea how many artillery shells you need to put down a militarily effective barrage of chemical agent You need 10,000 155 millimeter artillery shells. That's a lot. All right, so Iraq's got to produce enough agent to go into 10,000 artillery shells. All right, what kind of agent do they want? Sarin, Tabun? No, that stuff's old hat. It doesn't work against a modern fighting force like the United States. To take us on, you need VX nerve agent, the most deadly substance known to mankind. You hear that over and over and over again. VX nerve agent. So what kind of factory do we have in Najaf? A VX production facility? Oh, I heard that. Maybe it's a VX production facility. The guy who said it doesn't even know what a VX production facility is. A VX production facility is a modern industrial site. It has modern equipment. VX is very hard to produce. If it was so easy to produce, everyone would have it. The fact that only five nations have ever perfected a VX production technique tells you something about VX. Iraq tried, and they produced VX. We know they did. The VX that Iraq produced went unstable within 1 to 8 days of manufacture. 1 to 8 days. We know they produced it. We know they lied about it. But they could never perfect the stability of it. Iraq produced it in the low or the high 80s percentages. You need to get it up to 97% purity. And then you need to jam in some stabilizer up there to prevent these proteins from eating all the stuff. Iraq can only get it up to like 95%. So when they produced the VX, they put in their stabilizer, those proteins started eating away. And it would degrade the substance within 1 to 8 days. That's Iraqi VX. It's still dangerous during that period of time. But notice what I'm saying. You got to make enough VX to put into 10,000 artillery shells for it to be militarily viable. And it degrades in 1 to 8 days, which means you got to be constantly producing this stuff. Now, even after you produce it, you got to put it in the artillery shell, which means you need a filling station. And that's tough. That means you're going to be putting the agent into the munition in a safe manner. This is the most deadly substance known to man. The Iraqis, when they use their sarin, you know, highly effective sarin, they put it in a Scud warhead. We know they did that. They admitted it. They would fill the Scud warhead halfway up with isopropyl alcohol. And then right before they're ready to launch, because they couldn't stabilize this stuff, they would pour in the GB or GF mixture and mix it up. Very sophisticated. They filled a number of warheads in this way. They lost over 20 men doing this. Because as they're mixing it, the vapors are coming up and bam, they're dead. They're doing the goat dance on the ground. That's the sophistication of this program. But we're not talking about sarin, we're talking about VX, a sophisticated filling station. So maybe this was a filling station. Right up front, you see, because you got to bring the VX down and fill the munitions. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what Najaf was? It was a diesel storage facility. A diesel storage facility. There's no chemical weapons plant in Najaf. There's no chemical weapons plant in Iraq. Iraq doesn't have chemical weapons. Anthrax. They might have that. The president says so. He knows so. The president says, I know. In fact, Colin Powell sat before the Security Council and held up a vial. Remember that vial with the white powder? And he said, if Iraq had anthrax like this, one teaspoonful would kill thousands. And he's right. That anthrax that he held up was simulating the kind of anthrax that was used in October of 2001 in the terror attack against the United States Postal Service. And if Iraq had it, they could launch an attack like that, and we should be scared. But he didn't tell you the rest of the story. The only nation that makes anthrax of this nature, dry powder form, is the United States of America. In fact, it was Department of Defense anthrax. It was used by whoever perpetrated the attack of October 2001. It wasn't Iraq. If Colin Powell wanted to be honest, he would have held up a bottle of Coke and said, if Iraq had a teaspoon of anthrax like this, nothing would happen. This is all Iraq produced, liquid bulk agent. That's it. They produced a lot of it. But liquid bulk agent isn't a weapon. We should have learned something by reading about what happened in October. What killed the people exposed to anthrax? It got into their lungs. They have to inhale it, which means the dry powder form is milled down to 0.3 to 0.5 microns, so it comes into your lungs. If it's liquid, it's got to be turned into an aerosol. Little minor particles that get sucked into your lungs. Iraq never perfected that technique. Now, Iraq put liquid bulk agent into a warhead. The only way an Iraqi biological weapon is going to kill you is if it lands on your head. Because if it misses you, it goes in the ground, breaks open, and there's the sludge. But that's okay. We say they got anthrax, liquid bulk anthrax. Well, let's talk about that for a while. How do we know they have it?
Well, we know they produced it. They've admitted it. They say we produced 8,500 liters of it. Now, Iraq denied having a biological weapons program for 4 years. They finally admitted it, and we were deeply suspicious. Why are you hiding this, we said. They said, well, we just didn't want to acknowledge it. But now we admitted 8,500 liters produced at the Al-Hakam State Establishment. But you know how we found how we coerced them into admitting it? See, they denied it. We did our research, and we found that they had bought 25 tons of growth media. That's the nutrients used by scientists to grow bacterium. 25 tons is a lot. It's actually about 200 times more than what's needed in the totality of the legitimate biological research effort of Iraq. We said, it doesn't make any sense. The Iraqis tried to come up with excuses. Well, we just bought more than we needed and stuff like this. We didn't buy it. Finally, confronted with the evidence, Iraq acknowledged, yes, we have a biological weapons program. We're deeply sorry, and we're turning it over. And they did. They admitted it. We blew up the factory in 1996, blew it up. It's no longer there. But we said, okay, 8,500 liters, where is it? We destroyed it. Great. Give us documents to prove it. No, we did it unilaterally, you see, and it was all done by word of mouth. No documents here. So we took a look at the factory before we blew it up, and we said, this is a big factory, a modern factory. You got a lot of growth media. It was activated here. It stopped working there. We think you produced 25 tons. 25 liters, or 25,000 liters, excuse me. And the Iraqis went, no, only 8,500 liters. We said, no, but if this thing operated at full production capacity during the time allocated using all the nutrients available, you could have produced 25,000 liters. And he said, yeah, but, you know, we'd never done this before. We bought this factory, and we turned it on, and we, you know, it's difficult. You see, you start with a small culture, then you put it in a small fermentation unit, and you brew it up. And then you transfer it to a bigger fermentation unit, and you brew it up, and you keep transferring it. And bacterium's a living thing. If you screw up, it dies. And if it dies, it's no good to you. You got to do it right. Ask anybody who does industrial-scale fermentation. You always are purging batches of this stuff because you always screw it up. Even the best scientists screw it up. And the Iraqis said, we screwed it up. We'd, like, punch out a batch. It didn't work. We'd have to flush the system and start over again. In the end, we only produced 8,500 liters because we weren't that good. And I have to tell you, after being in Iraq for 7 years, I agree with them. They weren't that good. But because they lied to us, we're not going to take anything they say at face value. Iraq's going to have to demonstrate with substantive facts, with documented fact, that they only produced 8,500 liters. And until they do that, we assume they have 25,000 liters. But we know they don't have 25,000 liters because they took us to a site where they dumped this stuff, and we know they dumped a lot of it in there. And yet, what does the president always say when he talks about Iraqi anthrax? There are 25,000 liters of anthrax unaccounted for. That's what the president tells us. That's what Colin Powell says. Well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, that 25,000 is a hypothetical figure derived by the inspectors. It's not reality. But even if they had 25,000 liters, again, Saddam, make the apple go up. If you can do that, then I'll accept the following, that you can take liquid bulk agent that has a shelf life of 3 years under ideal storage conditions and make it last a decade. Can't happen, ladies and gentlemen. The last known batch of anthrax came out of the Al-Hakam State Establishment in 1991. Even if Iraq hid it from us, even if they maintained it, I'm a simple Marine, but 1991 plus three means in 1994 that stuff no longer works. For Iraq to have anthrax today, they would have had to reconstitute a manufacturing base since 1998. And there's no evidence that they've done so. So what anthrax, Mr. President? What threat? It seems to me that Iraq's been disarmed. It seems to me that we can document a fundamental level of disarmament. It seems to me that Iraq cannot be shown to constitute a threat to the national security of the United States or international peace and security. And yet John Negroponte, the ambassador, went before the Security Council last week and justified the American war against Iraq on the basis that Iraq does pose a threat. The president has convinced the American people that Iraq has these weapons, thereby posing a threat worthy of war. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a lie. We have been lied to.
You're listening to former United Nations weapons inspector, former U.S. Marine Major Scott Ritter, speaking in Ithaca on March 27th. This is Unwelcome Guests, broadcast on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We continue with Scott Ritter.